machine. Get on up, get up, get on up, get up, get on up. Bobby, should I take him to the bridge?
Go ahead.
Take him on to the bridge.
Take him to the bridge.
Can I take him to the bridge?
Yeah.
James Brown, the godfather of soul in Sex Machine, says, Bobby, can I take him to the bridge? His performances would include high-energy dances and interactions with his ensemble. Musical performers rely on costumes, improvisation, ornamentation, visual display, group dynamics, and other elements in ways that take music from the page to the stage. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
Whether we look at vocal ornamentation in 19th century opera or group improvisation in The Grateful Dead, we find performance a key element. What happens when scholars in musicology, who normally look at musical texts on the page, join forces with scholars in performance studies? Joining us to explore the new field of music as performance is Richard Pettengill, chair of the theater department at Lake Forest College and co-editor, along with Nicholas Cook, of a collection of provocative essays called Taking It to the Bridge, Music as Performance, published by the University of Michigan Press in 2013.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
So where is this bridge?
Well, you know, you heard James Brown talking about wanting to take him to the bridge. And, you know, in that case, he's talking about he's doing a kind of a funky vamp with that song Sex Machine. But then he wants to take him to a bridge, which is a different key for a little while, slightly different riff. And then he takes it back to where he was before. So taking it to the bridge is certainly the bridge in a musical sense. The bridge is a part of a song is one
usually
thing
like
that we'd like to talk about.
Usually like bridge between two.
Sure.
Choruses,
yeah,
two
and might be a vocal bridge as well, sometimes just a different part of a song. But part of what we wanted to try to do in this book was to think of bridge in a few ways. One is to bridge a couple of disciplines that had not really been communicating prior to this book. And those are the fields, as Emily mentioned, of performance studies and the field of musicology. So our attempt here is to kind of bridge people who have a common interest in performance but have not yet really been interacting with each other.
Well, and we think so often of a thing, of a work of art in a vacuum. I mean, a play, for example, you look at the text and you think, why did he do that? Why did he do that? Well, it's quite often that the playwright did it because of the players or even some immediate audience response.
Absolutely. I mean, that's one of the ideas is that whereas musicology, for example, has traditionally focused on the text of music, the score, you know, many of these scholars are saying now you really can't separate the performance of the music from the page on which it is written. And similarly, of course, in the theater, you can't really think about plays without thinking about their performance. Shakespeare certainly never wrote plays just to be read, you know, as literature in your study. He wanted to get them up on the Globe stage, and, you know, he wasn't worried even about publishing them so much. So it was about performing.
You're the chair of a theater department. What made you interested in sort of taking from that discipline of theater performance on a stage and then crossing over to music?
Well, I mean, music has been a personal passion of mine, you know, for my whole life. I'm a self-taught guitarist. I play in various bands. I played tuba and bass clarinet in school and so on. And so I actually had never even thought of the idea of thinking seriously about the performance of music until I encountered some of the scholars who are now in this book. And I thought, wow, that is a really exciting thing to think, you know, think seriously about the way music is performed. We kind of take it for granted. They're up there on the stage, they're playing. Well, if you look at what they're doing, how they're moving, how they've dressed, the kind of persona they're enacting or putting forth to an audience, there's a lot to think about and a lot of really interesting thoughts that you can come up with.
And that it goes back a long way. It's not just a phenomenon of the visual or video age. I mean, Franz Liszt, for example, when he performed, he'd come out wearing these gloves and he'd make a point of flinging them off before he sat down at the piano, and he would play two pianos. He'd play one facing this way and then come around and play another one facing that way. He was a showman, as was Paganini.
Absolutely. And some of the essays in the book actually deal with historical performances that we don't, of course, have any video record of, but we have slight references to in contemporary literature from which the scholars have kind of speculated things about the way the work was performed and sometimes the impact that it had socially and politically within the society.
Yeah, Johann Strauss was another one that comes to mind. He is was a violinist playing these all-night dance parties, you know, mm-hmm. putting on a show, making
right.
a show of it.
Right.
Certainly the costumes, if you think of Liberace or some of the others, where the, you know, obviously on radio we can't show some of that, but we certainly have seen the kind of elaborate
sure.
costumes that some performers will wear. Now, you chose in your own chapter within this book to talk about the Grateful Dead.
Yeah.
That's an odd choice. Tell us about that.
Well, I mean, you know, there again, it's just one of my favorite bands, and I first saw them when I was 15 years old, you know, at the Woodstock Festival, and so it's sort of seared in my consciousness. And one of the things that always struck me about them is that unlike, say, somebody like Liberace or even a more theatrical rock performer like David Bowie, they're not theatrical in the least. I mean, in fact, when you see them on stage, they're just kind of standing there in T-shirts and blue jeans and sandals or whatever, sneakers, and they're just kind of maybe looking down at their guitars. They don't kind of perform in the conventional sense of a lot of interaction with the audience, eye contact. They're just up there playing. So I always thought, yeah, they're just being themselves up there. They're just being authentic. They're just being who they are. But I started to think about this more as I got into this field and thought, well, you know, they're still performing. You know, they're still performing some version of themselves, sort of a performance of authenticity. They're still up there. So
you mean they're sort of projecting the image of a group that's not thinking about the audience? Is that partly a persona then that they're
I think it's a persona adopting? that they have created and enacted for the stage.
And I assume if you're talking about the Grateful Dead, you also are always aware of their intense followers.
Right. Right, and that's not something I've gotten too much into there. That's a huge topic in itself that's been dealt with by sociologists and ethnomusicologists at great length.
Since the recording industry started over 100 years ago now, that sort of persona or difference between performance and the actual playing the notes has kind of gone both ways, because you would get very fond of a track on an album and realize that they could never do that live.
Right.
And so that's one kind of persona, you might say, one kind of packaging. And the other is what they can do live that they can't do in a studio.
Yeah. I mean, and that's very true. It's always very interesting to see what a band can actually do on the stage without the magic of the studio. But sometimes they can do things that they weren't able to do in the studio, especially with, as you mentioned, the energy of the audience pushing them along.
So what do you think the Dead was selling in a live concert if they're not really playing that much to the audience?
Well, what they're doing is they're playing music. I mean, one of the things you don't hear much about the Grateful Dead, you hear mainly about the phenomenon of their followers who went around from city to city in their VW vans and were hanging out in the parking lot and making grilled cheese sandwiches and so on.
But no doubt.
Yeah, right. That's all they were ingesting. But they were brilliant. They are really still are. Those who have survived are brilliant musicians. And what I am particularly struck by in their music is their ability to collectively improvise along the lines of jazz musicians, the way, say, John Coltrane or Ornette Coleman would improvise collectively as an ensemble. The Grateful Dead, almost uniquely within the rock canon, was able to do so. And so what I wanted to take a look at in my essay is, how did they do it? How did they communicate on stage when they're all improvising all at the same time? How do they kind of make moves within the ensemble and push the group in a different direction, say, by kind of making a sort of a gesture in one direction? And how, most importantly in my essay, how do they decide what song to play next? In other words, they would go out of a group improvisation into a song.
They don't just have like a few titles written down on a post-it on somebody's guitar.
Yeah, I mean, I think these days they do have set lists, but at that time, and I think my essay shows that they didn't pre-plan what song to go into. So what
really,
I was
they improvised the whole set.
Well, certainly in that moment, they hadn't decided, because you can see part of what I talk about there is that Jerry Garcia plays a little D chord out of an improvisation.
So it could go to El Paso, or it could go to something else.
Could go to another song. And so, in fact, he seemed to have in mind a different song. And the rest of the band had the idea of El Paso. So there was this wonderful little moment where he started playing one song, the rest of them started playing another song, but then within seconds he picked up on what they were doing and jumped on the train and went with them. So paying attention in a video to the body language, to where they were standing, how they were facing each other or not, was to me very fascinating.
That was kind of a disaster for a Saturday Night Live performer not long ago, wasn't it? Somebody got the wrong signal, and she was lip syncing, and they put the wrong song on.
Right.
Now, who was it? I can't quite remember, but boy, it stuck out like a sore thumb.
Yep.
So those signals aren't always picked up by
them. Right. Let's listen to the clip you have from The Grateful Dead, and then you can talk about what we would see if we were looking at the visuals.
If we were to see, So I'm not sure you could pick out every little subtle nuance in the first seconds of that clip, but there was a moment where a very, very soft D chord was strummed by Jerry Garcia, the lead guitarist, and he started playing this other song in his head, I think, called Mountain Dew, because he then proceeded to play a little riff called da-da-da-da-da-da. Meanwhile, the rest of the guys are... They've heard that D chord, and there are plenty of songs that start with a D chord. So you could go any number of directions, and so they are off on that other direction, and he picked up on it right away.
So in a way, there's no mistakes in improvisation, because you can just turn a mistake into something else.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a big part of the point I wanted to make, is that this kind of, quote, mistake or misunderstanding is just part of what they do, their aesthetic. They explore together. Sometimes they have a slight momentary miscommunication, but then they ultimately get on the same train and go together.
Well, improvisation in general would bring out the fact that it's really difficult if you've got performers playing off each other and improvising in the moment. You can't write it down. You can't take what they're doing and put it on a piece of paper and ever recreate that sort of electrifying in-the-moment immediacy.
Right. And one of the central tenets of theatrical improvisation is the idea of yes and. When somebody offers you something, makes an offer, in other words, says something to you that enacts a sort of situation in a relationship, one of the rules is that you agree with it, yes, and then you add something and bring something to the table. So instead of denying what has been offered. So the yes and certainly applies to musical improvisation as well. Somebody makes an offer, go with it. It's just in this case, there was a bit of a misunderstanding. Or, you know, it's even possible that there was a denial there. It's possible.
No, we don't want to play that.
I don't really want to play that song. I mean, I don't think we'll ever know. And I doubt if, you know, from 1972, Bob Weir, the rhythm guitarist, could actually tell us, yeah, I didn't really feel like playing that song. So I went,
Well, there's another interesting phenomenon with the later days of recording, by which I mean 60s and forward. And that is the prevalence of sometimes even permitted recordings of the event by people in the audience.
Yes.
And so you get all these different versions. I mean, They did El Paso how many times? 65 times or something like that, or 365
hundreds.
Times, whatever it was. Yeah, and so each one of those would presumably be, well, even if it were a symphony orchestra, each one would be at least slightly different. But with a degree of improv like this are going to vary considerably.
Absolutely. I think that's why the Grateful Dead engendered such fanaticism on the part of their audience. The reason people followed them around so much is that they knew that every night would be entirely different and that it wasn't just going to be the same show over and over.
One of the essays that you include in your book by Philip Auslander is called Jazz Improvisation as a Social Contract. Can you talk about that? Because, you know, we've been talking about improvisation with the Grateful Dead, but what about this idea of jazz?
Yeah, he's interested in this idea of audiences and fellow musicians acknowledging the act of improvisation as it's occurring. He talks, for example, about Ella Fitzgerald, who one night there were a lot of crickets where she was staying, and she just improvised on stage a song about crickets, which was ended up being called the Cricket Song. So there's a case where it was clear that she was improvising, whereas I think one of the points he makes is that sometimes a performer will perform as though he or she is improvising, say, a solo. But in fact, back in their hotel room, they planned out the whole thing to sound as though it
planned
was improv.
Improv.
And wow, you came up with that in the moment. So it's, you know, but you still, he says, you still behave as if it's being improvised. And you actually have no way of knowing whether it was or not.
Well, let's listen to the Fitzgerald as
sure.
long as it's. As
yeah, why not?
Yet. Just give me a little vamp. Crickets on the left, crickets on the right. Crickets just singing with me all the night. What can I do? They're too much competition, but I love him. Oh, yes, I love him. What do I do? What do I say? I don't care anyway, cause they made this a happy night for me. So sing on, crickets. As long as they sing, we know it's a happy thing. Cause when they stop, that bop is over for me, over for me. So sing on, crickets, sing for me. Come on, crickets, sing with me. I don't care, I'm going on vacation now. You can sing anyway, anyhow.
A brilliant improvisation, because she never gets out of time at all. I mean, the words come just as if they had been written down. Of course, in the blues, that's what it's all about, is you repeat that first line, it gives you time to come up with the next one.
Right. And the blues, too, there's a kind of a set structure of the music, usually a 1-4-5 pattern that allows you a foundation on which you can improvise. But you could hear the audience, you know, kind of acknowledging and laughing at her ingenuity of being able to not only come up with these words, but they rhyme and they're in perfect rhythm.
Yeah, and it had a feel to it.
Yeah.
You know, it was of the moment.
And that's certainly alive today with the rap, hip-hop
sure.
tradition as well.
Right.
You've also got a clip from Miles Davis, So What?
Yes.
Tell us about that and what we can hear in that.
Well, what you'll hear in this clip from a live performance on television of Miles Davis and John Coltrane, pretty much the lineup that appeared on his classic album, Kind of Blue, is a transition from an improvised solo by Miles himself to John Coltrane. And you won't really see the physical dynamics of the performance space. But one of the things that he talks about is that there's kind of a batter's box or somebody up at bat, and that's the person currently doing the solo. There's kind of somebody about to be up at bat, and that's the person getting ready to do the next solo. And then there's the dugout back here where people are waiting for their opportunity to come out and play. So we'll just listen to this and we'll just see the transition between these two jazz artists.
Video that shows Miles Davis passing it off to Coltrane, you do see them physically walking around each other, kind of maneuvering for position. That's what you're talking about.
Exactly. There is kind of a place where the soloist is going to be when they're soloing, and then Miles kind of pulls back to respectfully listen as Coltrane proceeds with his solo.
It's theatrical.
It is. I mean, it's a kind of a form of blocking, you know, that,
right.
that there's an appropriate place to be.
Blocking and lighting.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah.
What about the idea of responding to an audience, the sort of call and response attitude of, you know, in other words, every performance of a play or of a concert is going to be different depending on who's in that hall.
Absolutely. And that's, of course, one of the great joys of live performance is that part of the ways in which every performance is going to differ is according to the way in which each individual audience will respond. So with theater, of course, from night to night, actors will tell you that it's an entirely different experience for them night to night, given, you know, they always say, how's the house? Mm-hmm. You know, and that's, of course, what's the audience like tonight?
Sometimes they laugh a lot.
Right.
Sometimes the same scene will get no laugh.
Sometimes they're just dead as...
And you have to adjust your timing to that.
Absolutely.
As an actor.
Yeah. Certainly when there's laughter, you've got to adjust.
And if there's alcohol, you can get things yelled out. And
that's right.
Lots can happen in live performances.
Yep.
More on music as performance when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. I just want to be of use to my ancestors. That's a comment by Abby Lincoln, a performer. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Richard Pettengill, who's the co-editor of a book called Taking It to the Bridge, Music as Performance. One of the essays that struck me in your collection was on Abby Lincoln and her so-called screaming singing and the way it would evoke the memory of slavery and sort of the voices, as she says, of her ancestors. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, you'll hear in a minute what the author of that essay, Aida Mabou, is talking about. And she takes this idea from another guy named Fred Moten, that Abby Lincoln invokes what he calls bone-deep listening. In other words, listening that evokes sort of specters of the past, of African-American oppression. And so for Lincoln, Aida says, this is the most powerful form of protest that she could possibly enact in the present day through her music by doing what she calls screaming singing. It's just kind of a very visceral, powerful enactment of the kind of rage and sorrow that Abby herself must feel about just the condition, the fact, the historical fact of slavery.
And so what we're going to hear is from her song Triptych.
Yes, well, it's a three-part song, and the middle part is called Protest, I believe, and that's the part we'll hear.
I bet she didn't sing that 365 times.
I hope not, for her own sake. Yeah.
As far as the improv, it's kind of between her and the drummer, right?
Max Roach.
Not room for a lot. Oh, was that Max Roach?
Max Roach.
Not a lot of room for anyone else.
Yeah. It? So that's part of a larger piece which Max Roach called We Insist Freedom Now. But you know, so it's a protest. It's an angry, passionate response to the situation of African Americans. And, you know, what can you say?
I mean,
it's just visceral, guttural, entirely improvised from the soul, from the heart, screaming singing that is, as Fred Moten said, bone deep. I mean, it goes right into your spinal cord.
And with echoes, as the essay writer points out, echoes of Frederick Douglass and this notion of the sort of incoherent but incredibly powerful sound of suffering. You hear that. Well, let me ask you, you know, what would the discipline that you're in, performance studies, add to our understanding of a performance like that that we just heard?
Well, one interesting thing about this particular essay is that it's based primarily on an audio recording. In other words, here's an example of a scholar talking about performance, but she's not so much thinking about the visual. She's listening to the sound of the performance and thinking about that in terms of this bone-deep listening. But, you know, most often performance studies focuses on visual phenomena. So, you know, performance studies is a field that began really as kind of a marriage of theater and anthropology. And two scholars in those two fields got together and said, well, we're both interested in performance. The anthropologist was interested in the performance, the everyday rituals of indigenous cultures. And the theater director, performance studies guy, was interested in performances on stage, like we might go to see, whether it's music, dance, theater, whatever, but also performances that we enact every day in our lives, the way in which we perform in every situation we're in. So between those two, they kind of created this field of performance studies, which has now been embraced throughout, you know, universities throughout the world. And so ordinarily, you wouldn't think a great deal about performance prior to the introduction of this field or analyze it deeply. And here's Aida Maboa taking an audio recording and thinking a great deal about the performance of a piece of music, even without being able to see the artist perform.
So where would you go from screaming, which is maybe the ultimate kind of performance, I mean, reduced to its barest bones, as you might say. If this, let's call this your playlist, where do you go from there?
In other words, what would I play next?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you know, maybe we should have saved that one for the last. Yeah, that's pretty much the ultimate expression.
You also, in your book, include an essay that looks at the transformation of sort of girl and boy groups into more radical performers. Can you talk about that and give us some samples?
Sure. This is an essay by Margaret Savalonis of the University of New Haven, and she's kind of interested in looking at the way in which boy groups and girl groups from the 50s and 60s kind of evolved as we made our way into the 70s, past African-American sort of norms or stereotypes, you might say, into more radical forms of performance or performative expression. So she's taking two examples in her essay. One is the Bluebells, or Patti LaBelle in the Bluebells. And the other example is the Parliaments, the group that then became Parliament Funkadelic, or P-Funk, under George Clinton. And he's a complete wild man and continues to be to this day an amazing performer.
So would this be from the late 50s into the early 70s, early mid-70s?
Yeah, late 60s, early 70s, as they evolved, not only musically, but visually as well.
Right.
They all began to wear wild, crazy costumes and feathers and
well, if you
so
look
on.
At the LaBelles, for example,
yes.
Their publicity photo, I don't know how they do it with the hair, but they talk about bouffant. I mean, you know, their hair is as high as the rest of their face, and they look like four prom dates, you know, or senior pictures or something like that.
Right.
But then by the time they get to Lady Marmalade, it's yeah. Pretty radical, as you say, transformation.
Yeah. So you can hear if we start with those ones, hear the sound of the Bluebells into the sound of
Lady Marmalade.
Lady Marmalade. So we'll start first with a clip of the Bluebells, Patti LaBelle's early group, and what they sounded like in the late 50s and early 60s. And then gradually they, you know, they began to question some of the formalities or conventions of their dress, their behavior, their performative behavior.
Squareness.
Squareness, whatever, and evolved into La Belle with a far more personal and flamboyant performance style. And the music, of course, becomes far more provocative and...
Voulez-vous coucher? Yeah, avec. Voulez-vous. Wow, that's pretty
exactly.
Provocative.
Exactly. So here's Lady Marmalade.
Definitely has a different kind of attitude.
What did they? What did they get into?
that got them there.
It's like Jekyll and Hyde, isn't it?
Definitely, quite an evolution. And similarly for the Parliaments into Parliament Funkadelic or P-Funk, there's quite a radical shift. So first the Parliaments.
And what would we see if we were watching this, that early version?
Probably they would be all uniformly dressed in very polite, you know, V-neck sweaters or something like that and doing very orchestrated simultaneous dance moves.
And very neat hair.
Very neat hair, yes, probably pomaded and so on. But then, you know, when we get to P-Funk, we move from concerns like, you know, don't get sore at me to kind of space obsession and political engagement, anger, and so on. So let's take a listen to P-Funk.
A good evening. Do not attempt to adjust your radio. There is nothing wrong. We have taken control as to bring you this special show. We will return it to you as soon as you are grooving. Welcome to station WEFUNK, better known as WeFunk, or deeper still, the Mothership Connection. Home of the extraterrestrial brothers, dealers of funky music, P-Funk, Uncut Funk, The Bomb.
Coming to you directly from the mothership, top of the chocolate Milky Way, 500,000 kilowatts of P-Funk power. So kick back, dig, while we do it to you in your eardrums. Oh, me, I'm known as Lollipop Man, alias the long-haired sucker. My motto is...
Make my the P-Funk.
It's hard to tell how much of it is artist-driven and how much of it's market-driven. Mm. I mean, because it's quite possible that the Parliaments weren't getting play by 1964 or 5, and so they had to reinvent themselves. You don't know which,
absolutely.
Which was push and which was pull.
Right. There could be lots of factors behind an evolution of that kind, but I think clearly you're moving toward a more personal kind of expression or a less convention-driven kind of expression in both of these cases.
And what about the impact of civil rights, of the black arts movement and so on? How do you, with both the Bluebells and then also with the Parliaments, How do you see the change in date between the early examples and the later ones really being a reflection of the historical context we're talking about?
Oh, I think absolutely that it's in part a kind of a transgressive response to a kind of oppression of being told that this is what a group is. You must dress this way. You must perform in this way. Actually, no, we're going to actually perform precisely the way we choose according to who we are and our own inner impulses. So I think it's all part and parcel and certainly affected by political movements like the civil rights movement at the time.
I mean, civil rights movement was, of course, one of the major political themes of the 60s. But if you're thinking of imagining or seeing the images of a group that would personify that kind of change that you just described from the kind of generic or institutional to the personal, it would be the Beatles. I mean, the Beatles between Meet the Beatles and the Ed Sullivan Show in 1964, where they're all in the same suits, you know, and the hair sure is long, but it's neat. Between that and by the time you get to Sgt. Pepper, man, we're in a different planet.
Absolutely. I mean, it's the subversion of expectation. I mean, they started, you know, with their manager, Brian Epstein, telling them they must wear collarless suits and pointy boots and so on. And after he passed away, they were not being told by anybody what to do or what music to write or what to express. And so we get from there to Helter Skelter or any number of...
And just like 5 years.
Yeah. An astonishing evolution over a total of 7 years for the Beatles.
What kind of interesting overlap do you see between literature and music performance? I was thinking of the way Nina Simone, for example, would perform, take a Langston Hughes blues poem and set it to music and perform it, or just the way the musician who's taking lyrics from something else can kind of take a literary text and then set it. How were some of the performers that you've looked at or are interested in affected by the Richard Wrights and Ralph Ellisons and Langston Hughes, you know, what is happening within what would be traditionally literature?
I do think that, you know, the literature of certainly, say, the 60s was part of the cultural influence that ended up taking form in music in the form of music that was explicitly angry, protest move music. For example, the Nina Simone example is a good example of, you know, pulling literature into the realm of music and expanding its impact by giving it a new form.
And we'll look at some newer dimensions in the relationship between music and performance when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Richard Pettingill, and we're looking at this connection. It seems obvious on the face of it between performance and music, and yet there's so many dimensions to it that are easily overlooked. And we were just talking about these groups that evolved in a fairly short period of time from something that would be pretty conventional in the late 50s, early 60s, into something that would be very individualistic and unpredictable by the time you get into the 70s. But are there examples of performers or groups that disappear every now and then? You hear about one of these. They're well known, they disappear, and then suddenly they resurface in a different package completely.
Well, a good example of that is the singer Lauryn Hill, who made a huge impact with her first record, which was called The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill, and then reemerged some years later. She kind of dropped out of sight. I guess she, you know, had some children and wasn't thinking about it. And then there was this film called Dave Chappelle's Block Party, and she's in that film. And she was kind of a surprise guest, and she came out and did a version of a very famous song from the 70s, Killing Me Softly with His Song, originally by Roberta Flack. And then starts going into a radically different style with the song and gives an entirely new dimension to the performance with this different style. So let's take a listen to that.
Strumming my pain with his finger, singing my lie with his words. Oh, he was killing me softly with his song, killing me softly with his song, telling my whole life with his word, killing me softly with his song.
That's quite a transition that yes. happens in that song.
Absolutely.
The difference between that and the Roberta Flack is, I mean, the Roberta Flack kind of exudes this vulnerability.
Yes.
Whereas this exudes, if that's even the right word, an edginess, an anger.
Yeah, exactly. I think she's recasting a song with an entirely new attitude and fervor. And again, with the contrast of styles in that rendition is really, really a very powerful performance. And the author of that essay, Daphne Brooks from Princeton University, is really interested in looking at the way this comeback performance kind of is kind of a window on what she calls the politics of post-soul cultural memory.
Whoa.
Yeah.
So there's a,
you want to deconstruct that for us?
There's a kind of an academic phrase for you. But anyway, so she calls it neo-soul or post-soul. In other words, after the primary heyday of what we call soul music.
Right.
But looking at a memory of earlier renditions of soul music with a contemporary attitude or fervor that we just never would have envisioned before.
And what is it that we heard there where, you know, she starts out the song and she's obviously improvising a little bit or sliding around with the notes compared to the Roberta Flack, but then when she hits the word song at one point, she kind of does a quavery thing and then gets to be, you know, much more rhythmic and hard-hitting with the notes. That transition fascinated me, and it seemed as if the audience was with her.
Very much with her and responding, you know, in the moment to, first of all, a surprise performance by a very iconic performer who had pretty much dropped out of sight, but also such a radical and powerful kind of radical reinterpretation of a canonical, you know, an iconic song of the early 70s.
But it's almost as if she's coming back in and saying, well, you didn't kill me. I'm here.
I'm still here.
Sounded close for a while there, but yeah. But she comes across as surviving this song.
Right. She has prevailed.
You also, in your book, talk about the field of ethnomusicology and the fact that one way that music as performance, as a discipline, can help is by looking at a piece of music in the context of a particular country or culture.
Yeah, so we were very happy when Ingrid Monson of Harvard University wanted to do an essay on a performer from Mali named Niba Solo. And she's really interested in this performer who's very popular in that country. And she talks in her essay about his music and how it articulates relationships between what she calls tradition and modernization. She's a musicologist, and so she looks carefully at musicological aspects of the music itself.
And excuse me a minute, but I know this is late in our program to ask this, but what would be a good definition of a musicologist?
Somebody who studies music. I mean, you know, the Greek derivation of the term musicology is the study of music. Traditionally, that has meant studying the score, just as literary scholars might study the text. And so there is this, for example, this distinction between dramatic critics who study just the text of a play, while others might say, no, the performance is essential. So musicologists have increasingly begun to acknowledge performance as an essential part of studying music. But traditionally, they have not.
So what's the distinction between a musicologist and an ethnomusicologist? Isn't it all kind of ethnic in its way?
Well, I mean, I guess if you're studying Mozart or Haydn,
sure, it's the good old Germanic culture.
There
you
go.
Know?
But I guess we're particularly thinking about music in particular cultures, sometimes third world cultures. And so in this case, we're looking at the country of Mali. And she's interested in how this music is functioning, not only in terms of multiple performances of the piece, but also how it functions within the political situation of the country in which he lives and works.
So tell us what we're going to hear in this upcoming clip.
What statement is he making?
Yeah. So, this is a piece called, I think, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, Chakise. And she's talking about what she calls Senufo counterpoint, to talk about what she calls the social dimension of the performance. So, you know, let's see what we think when we take a listen to the music.
From a purely, you know, uninformed non-speaker of that language, I would say this sounds polite and, you know, almost easy to listen to.
Yeah, and here's a case where, you know, the scholar who's writing about this musician is going beyond the music itself to the kind of political and historical context in which the music is being made, studying what she sees as his role within the social and political fabric of the country of Mali and talking about how his music functions there. He's apparently the most popular musician in Mali, or best known, and he's playing a kind of a xylophone there. But she's looking at all kinds of dimensions of the music that we probably can't really hear in that clip, but are informed by further research and further experience and that she's studied in that country and has met this musician.
What does she find?
Well, that for the people in Mali who hear this music, there is a dimension that we probably can't hear that has, you know, a powerful impact in terms of, again, the politics and social dimensions of that culture.
There's something in the lyrics that's providing commentary that would be controversial, perhaps?
I think so, yeah.
It is interesting when you travel abroad and hear music because you know that you're missing out on the history behind so much of what you're hearing performed, and that what might come across as sounding polite and tinkling even might be very filled with rage or, you know, be subversive or witty, and you can't get the translation in the same way. You know, there's a Miles Davis song that we mentioned called So What? And I'm going to ask you the So What question now about the field of music performance. You've got all these different essays that definitely make us start to think about the various kinds of musical performances that we've watched, whether it's a Gilbert and Sullivan operetta or a Rolling Stone concert or a Chicago Symphony concert. I mean, there's all kinds of different music everywhere. If the collections of essays in your book and others like it do their job, what would we get out of music performances that we don't now?
You know, I think our hope is that if you take a look at some of the essays in here, you might just start to think a little more deeply about the physical or the visual dimension of the performances that you're witnessing. For example, I mean, you mentioned symphony orchestras. There's a whole world of convention among classical musicians in terms of dress decorum, comportment on stage, the whole ritual of the tuning up before the playing of the symphony,
yep, right.
The way one behaves when the conductor comes in.
Yeah, very structured.
And the first chair violinist as opposed to the others, and ways of performing that we may not spend a lot of time thinking about as we listen to the music. I think we tend to focus on the music we hear in performances. And this is a field that invites us to look a little more deeply at the way musicians behave on stage, how they dress, the props they bring with them on stage, their choice of instrument in terms of how it looks on stage. Certainly that applies to popular music a great deal, with various kinds of guitars that you can buy and so on, to think about what kinds of meanings are being conveyed by a musician visually in terms of, again, this idea of what is being projected in terms of persona on stage, what character has been created and pulled together for the purposes of performance, which is a whole other dimension, which is related to the music being played, but is in its own way a different thing to focus on when we experience music performances.
Well, if you want a topic that would provide endless room for essays, you could start doing studies of karaoke.
You certainly could.
And how people who are various degrees of, let's say, non-professional musicians usually respond to a context of a familiar professional performance.
I know a young man who's doing his dissertation on the performance of karaoke. So,
well, I see a trip to Japan for him, where it's certainly a runaway phenomenon.
Yeah.
You do include an essay about music in video games, even.
Yes.
And certainly, with YouTube and all kinds of media, there's all kinds of room for different sorts of performances these days.
Right. I mean, there was a brief heyday of these video games like Rock Band and so on, and where you could get a little plastic guitar and essentially
right.
perform along with music performances and become a part of the music in a different way. Yeah.
Yes, it becomes very modular and very, I suppose, democratized too after a while. Anyone can play.
Anybody can play in a rock band.
Well, thanks for joining us for this hour. It's been really thought-provoking.
Thank you very much for having me.
Our guest is Richard Pettingill. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.
The way it is, I've got my ticket, he's got his. Stay on the scene, like a loving machine. Stay on the scene, like a loving machine. Stay on the scene. I want to count it off one more time now.
Go ahead.
You want to hit it like it did on the top, fellas? Hit it like it did on the top. Hit it now. Get on up.
Get on up.
Get up.
Get on up.
Get up.
Get on up.
Get on up.
Get on up.
Stay on the scene.
Get on up.
Like a loving machine.
Get on up.
Get up.
Get on up.
Taste.
Get on up.
A piano.
Get on up.
Taste.
Get on up.
A piano.
Get on up.
Right on, right on. Right on, right on.